This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and for readers to read a good book. And also for all of you people out there who are looking at your electric bills, think solar energy, because it is just going to be so beautiful. We're heading now into this wonderful, wonderful weather. It's going to be sunny every day. You need solar energy so you can go EHS. Now, before I start, I just want to say this is a busy day. I have three wonderful authors, and I'm starting today with one of the most beautiful books I've gotten, in ages, and it's just fantastic. It's a National Geographic book, and it's called Treasury of Magical Tales from Around the World. And the author is Donna Jo Napoli. Hi, Donna.
Hello.
Wow, what a book.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is a beautiful, beautiful book.
I agree. The illustrator is phenomenal.
And her name is Christina Ballett, right?
Right.
And beautiful, beautiful. Oh, well, of course, it's a Nat Geo book, so we know it's going to be gorgeous. Oh, I love Nat Geo books so much. And the stories that you've written are fascinating, and they're so interesting. And the way she's illustrated them, very dramatically, very colorfully, they are really beautiful illustrations.
Yes. Christina and I have been a team on a series of books with National Geographic. This one is the first one that is a collection of tales. Otherwise, we've done things that are from a single country.
I know you did Egyptian mythology and Greek mythology, Arabian Nights, which is a beautiful one, and of course the Bible stories.
And we did Norse mythology, and so that's the I'm so delighted to be working with Christina.
Well, she's a brilliant artist. The illustrations are so incredible that you get lost in them. They're detailed, and everything, you know, she captures the stories that you've written. So tell us, and also I want to add, there are these little inserts of facts, which is, you know, typical for National Geographic. They always want to make sure that we learn something along the way, and beautifully done, those little inserts. But, of course, it's all carried by your wonderful stories.
Well, actually, I write the sidebars myself, because when I pick a story to tell, I'm often picking it because it has the opportunity, it offers the opportunity to learn something about a place. My main goal in telling a story is to have somebody, the reader, just have fun. You know, you as a writer can't control what your reader is going to take away from your story, but you can offer and hope that they have fun. And the nice thing about these little sidebars is that the teacher part of me, which is separate from the writer part of me, can have some fun too, and I can point people to different things that may help them enjoy the story.
Well, I think so. And, of course, it's also a wonderful resource for the parents when they read these little sidebars and give them more ideas on where to go further to help teach their children, because now so many parents are teaching their children at home.
Well, that's true, too, yeah.
So your book here is a nice, the Adventure Stories from Around the World, it's a perfect book, actually, for a homeschooling family, because they can go around the world and read the stories, get the kids intrigued about a country or an area, and then, you know, start the research, make maps, and do all sorts of fun and exciting things, and learn geography along the way.
I'm glad you say that, because I picked the stories very carefully. There are some countries that had so many stories that I loved, and there were countries close to each other that had so many stories I loved, but I would pick just one story from a kind of area of the world so that we could go around the world. The actual stories, though, what happens in them, as opposed to the society in which they take place, but what happens is very particular and may not reflect much about the country today and the values of the country today. They're often quite universal in terms of worries, values that people have anywhere.
Well, and I did notice that. As a former homeschool mom, I spent years teaching my kids history really by geography, and I liked the way I noticed that you had spaced them out around the world, so we really do get a trip around the world. So tell us about some of them. All of them are fascinating. I love the one, The Girl and the Moon Spirit. Tell us about that one.
Oh, I love that one, too. Good. That story, yeah, I want to pull it in front of me because I don't have...
Well, I'll just read while you're looking for it. It starts off far north in the Arctic lands. Right away, the kids get sort of thrilled, right, and they look at that beautiful illustration of her. Oh, it's so...
I don't have my pricey in front of me, but... The thing about that story that's very disturbing is that this moon spirit just fixates on this girl and wants her. Fortunately, she has a wonderful reindeer who can help her, who is magic, and who can help her transform into something else so that the moon spirit can't find her. What I find fascinating there is the idea that when you are in a desperate situation, when you are perhaps the victim of something, magic can help you. It can transform you. This young woman is actually literally transformed into different objects in a room, in a tent, so that the moon spirit can't find her. And a real person today could transform themselves mentally. You can bring yourself somewhere else so that the harm that's being done to you can, in fact, be deflected to a certain extent. Whatever, the magic is there. And what I find beautiful about this story, too, is I wish I had it in front of me so I could point to details, but the moon spirit gives up and wanders around heartsick for the girl. He's really fixated on her. And he becomes so thin and so weak that it looks like he's going to die. And she has pity on him and shows herself to him. And he recovers. She forgives him for the terrible thing that he's done. And she's willing to talk with him. It's quite beautiful. I think that the notion of forgiveness comes up over and over in the stories, the power of forgiveness, because so much injustice goes on in the world, particularly of injustice toward people of lower socioeconomic classes in these stories. And they'll often just go on with their lives, accepting the beauty that they can have in life and forgiving the wrongs that have stolen certain things from them.
Well, all of your stories have deep meaning, and the wonderful thing about them, they are engaging. The children will love them. They will immediately, I think, bond with your characters. And like this one, with a reindeer, and we've always thought of Rudolph with the red nose as being magical, and so it's not far away from this that we can believe that this is an absolutely beautiful and magical reindeer. Then one of the other stories that I really liked is the Island of the Ogres. Whoa, and the illustrations for that one, fantastic.
Yeah, and that's a very different sort of story in terms of the magic in that story. The problems in that story are of a different sort. Ogres are magical people, magical creatures that eat human beings. The moon spirit was, while he's a moon spirit, what he wanted to do was take a woman as his wife against her will, a more common situation. Today, we don't really fear being eaten. But what I love in the ogre story is that the man is willing to try to understand the ogres, and they are willing to try to understand him. And he becomes integrated into their community. He is presented with an ogre wife who at first he doesn't trust at all, but they have some experiences together. They tell each other stories. They sit under the moon together. They fall in love, a very unlikely and beautiful love, and they have children. But then one day he leaves, goes back to his human society, and eventually his son comes back and brings home his wife and two others of his children. And he's reunited in the human community, and the human community is far less accepting of the ogre than the ogre community was of the human. Eventually, they come to respect her because she is such an amazing warrior, but they don't kind of respect her just because she's a living being that has needs and is at all like them.
Well, I think it's a beautiful, beautiful story. The illustration, the Emerald Princess illustration, is one of the it's fantastic. Now, we don't have a lot of time today, but I wanted to say that I'm going to contact you. I want to invite you back. I would like to talk about all of your books, and particularly I would like to talk to you about your trip to Iran.
Sure.
Because I lived in Iran for many years, and so I was very intrigued with how you got to Iran and what Iran is like now, because when I left, it was I left in a rush, let's say. I was one of the last foreigners out of the country. So I would...
I visited Iran in 2005.
Yeah, I know. I saw. So I would love to hear about your adventures in Iran. So I will be contacting you. But meanwhile, as I said, we don't have much time left. Do you want to give your email address? Your webpage.
My webpage is just DonnaJoNapoli.com.
Okay.
That's my name. DonnaJoNapoli, no periods, no capitals.
Okay, well, Donna Jo, you're going to be back here soon, and we'll talk about more. But right now, The Treasury of Magical Tales from Around the World, a National Geographic book, a fantastic book. And thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Donna Jo, and I will have you back soon, okay?
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Okay, well, this book, if you have a kid in your life, get this book. The illustrations are amazing, lovely stories, and of course, it's a National Geographic book, and I love National Geographic books, which brings me to my next guest, who is like the major National Geographic guy, Joel Sartori. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, I'm so happy to have you back. I always, always love everything that you do. You are so, so amazing. I think you're the greatest photographer in the whole wide world. Wow.
Gee whiz.
Well, now, well, your photo arc, of course, the newest book is just so beautiful. And the accompanying book, the photo arc ABC, oh, just wonderful. So tell us. Wow, they keep you busy, don't they?
They do, yeah. They grant fund the majority of the cost of the project. So, yeah, I'm out all over the world when it's not full-on pandemic. I was just in the United Arab Emirates and Peru and going to Costa Rica in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, we're real busy with these two books. We're really trying to showcase just things that we think would be interesting and entertaining.
Well, you certainly do. And, of course, as always, all of your photography is so gorgeous. And with the new book, there were so many that I was really intrigued with. One of them, of course, it's the National Geographic Photo Ark Wonders, Celebration of a Diversity in the Animal Kingdom is the official name. So,
right.
Wow. And there are so many, you must have so many exciting stories that I don't know, someday you have to write your own just stories about your stories. One of the animals that I found so intriguing is the one in Madagascar. And I want to hear about that story, because that sounds like it was maybe a little bit dangerous what you were doing to get a picture of the Deccan. It's called what? Deccan siphacus?
Yes, or some people call them siphax, but it looks like siphaca when you read it.
So how should it be pronounced?
Oh, they say siphax.
Siphax.
But also siphaca. It looks like siphaca, so that's how I say it. But this is a kind of a prehistoric primate. These are animals that, this group of animals, they are predecessors to monkeys, what we know as monkeys in the zoonotic world. So this was a place that, you know, at the tip of Madagascar, and to get there, it's a real journey. In the areas we were in, you really didn't want to be on the roads after dark, and it's just, you know, the whole place is an adventure all the time, but it's kind of typical for this project that by the time we get to the animals, a lot of the problems have been solved in terms of, well, how are we going to photograph this animal? Can we shift it into a shooting kennel or a softbox? Can we shift the animal into a space that's been painted black or white if it's a larger animal? And you tend to forget all the troubles along the way once you get the photographs, you know, and you get back on that airplane and come home. In the case of Madagascar, though, it's typical of that part of the world. It's just not, it's not Western Europe, you know, it's not Australia.
Oh, no, it's not comfortable. It's not the most comfortable place to travel, and it's also pretty dangerous. There's so many just natural dangers of disease and everything else. It's not easy.
Yeah, and getting held up, getting robbed, that kind of thing. So you want to make sure that you're with a group that knows what they're doing, and you're with good local guides, local producers that really can help guide you through. We've had very few problems over the years because we try to do things in a very smart way and showcase these different countries' beautiful, beautiful creatures. We're not political. We just want to get in and photograph all the wonders that they have, make everybody look good, including the facility that houses the animal, and move on to the next.
Well, is this an endangered species? I would think there aren't that many.
Well, most of the animals in Madagascar are in trouble because of deforestation there and the burgeoning human population. I mean, that's the key in all this. We really do need to set aside vast tracts of habitat in order to save not only plants and animals, but ourselves. But we really do need equatorial rainforest to keep the planet cool, filter our air, provide us with oxygen to breathe, and also to regulate rainfall patterns and keep rains coming into the areas where we had good soil and the know-how to grow the crops that feed the world. So as we cut down everything, as we strain all the fish out of the sea, as we mine and pillage and plunder and pave, it really is going to come at a cost to us. So what we really hope the photo arc accomplishes is we get people to stop and marvel and think, this is so worth saving. What can we do in our daily lives to save these animals? What can we do? Well, there's a lot we can do. We're big consumers in the United States. we're voting with our purse or our wallet every day. We are saying to a retailer, I like this, I'm going to buy it, do it again and again. That's big. But also just growing a pollinator garden in your backyard. Stop pouring poisons all over your lawn, like fertilizers, insecticides, herbicides. That's big. There's just so many things that all of us can do. But I think people need to be aware of what they can do. And I can tell you, it ain't over. There's so much we're saving. We still have most of the species we arrived here with, and most can be saved. But we have to start paying attention to really do.
Well, of course, that's what National Geographic has done for over 100 years, bringing us these wonderful stories about animals around the world so that we do. I, as a child, it was a National Geographic magazine, and that's the only magazine that we ever had in our house because we were very poor, but my father got that subscription, and we looked forward to that, and it was because of that, there was a photograph of a giraffe, and ever since then, I have always collected giraffes, and I have a 10-foot giraffe outside my front door. because of National Geographic.
Yeah, I always wanted to work for them even as a child. And I always wanted to be a wildlife photographer for National Geographic. And I may not be the smartest guy, but I'm persistent. And so it's worked out.
Well, I think it's worked out very, very well for you. You have just done such a marvelous job. Every one of the photos in this book are just... You can get lost in them. They are so amazing. There's just a simple little story about them. And I like that you have the names in Latin because I studied Latin for 4 years in high school, and I love seeing that. And again, that's something that I think it helps people to perhaps think a little bit more about you know, learning something. And one of the ones that I loved, it's the one that the monkey that looks like Jimmy Durante, the proboscis.
Yes, proboscis monkey. That's right. Yeah.
Tell us about that one. Where'd you take that one?
That was a big mature male with the giant nose, so big that a lot of the males with big noses, they have to lift it up in order to eat, believe it or not. That was at Wildlife Reserve Singapore. And they're very strong, and they're very fierce. They're really large primates. So the shoot was just, you know, maybe 3 minutes tops. And we basically had a transfer shoot from his indoor to outdoor space lined with black and stopped him in the middle of that and photographed him very quickly, and then he was on his way. But in all these shoots, we work really closely with the zoos to try to figure out, okay, which animals would tolerate this photographic process? How long would we have with them? What other things do we need to know? We're really careful to try to reduce stress. And if we can't do it, we don't. We move on. Maybe we'll get a chance at that animal at some other facility. Something that's been hand-raised and it's much more calm. Never know.
And you go from this giant species to the tiny stick insects.
Right. That's right. Yeah. We photograph anything you can see with the naked eye, really, if it's in human care or in a controlled situation. So it could be the insects, bees, butterflies, beetles, ants. We've even photographed mosquitoes at a pest control lab in Florida, believe it or not, Egyptian mosquitoes, which bring a lot of disease to people. We photograph fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals. Just anything that you can see.
Oh, like the fairy shrimp. I love those fairy shrimp.
Yeah, and they are an amazing animal that have a life cycle that lasts just a few weeks. They live in puddles of water created by rain, called vernal pools, temporary pools, and they go from dry egg and dry dirt, growing up, sexual maturity in just a few days, and then they lay eggs, fertilized eggs, and die when the little puddle dries up. And they're tiny. I mean, they're not even as big as a dime. They're much smaller than that. So it's really important, I think, though, that people realize that the world's a very diverse place. There's a lot more to biodiversity than just gorillas tigers, and that all these animals are worth saving.
Oh, they are. Well, you've done a marvelous job, and of course, to go along with the big book of how many photos are there in that one? So many.
A couple hundred
photos in that one. To go along with that is the ABC photo arc. I love this one. Oh, it is so adorable. There are animals here that I had never seen before. I didn't even know they existed. And it was, again, you captured them so beautifully. You know, one of the ones that I couldn't believe, I thought to myself, did you make it up? The Katy did.
No, believe it or not. Yeah, isn't that something? What part of the country are you in right now?
Florida, Clearwater, Florida.
Okay, so this is the oblong-winged Katy. You may have them in your backyard and not even know it. They're very common, at least in the Great Plains where I live here in Nebraska. But they're a very wide-ranging species. They might extend over to Florida.
Well, I thought...
an animal out in the color green.
Yeah.
So the babies can hide very easily. Now, the deal with nature and biodiversity is nature's always trying new things. So every few thousand eggs, one hatches out in orange, pink, yellow. And at the Audubon Insectarium in New Orleans, they were breeding this species to see the color morphs and to show the color morphs. And so every once in a while, something hatches out pink. Now, that color in nature would be seen by birds and eaten that day. You could not hide if you're pink in a green world. At Audubon Insectarium, they had them, and they were alive, and they were amazing.
Well, Joel, as always, I never have enough time with you. I know that, you know, this has to be cut short now, but the photo arc, the big one, the National Geographic Photo Arc Wonders Celebrating Diversity in the Animal Kingdom, is just beautiful. And everybody, if you have a kid in your family, if you know any kids, or if you want to send a book to a hospital, a children's hospital, get this Photo Arc ABC with Joel's beautiful, beautiful photographs.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
And what's the best website for people to go to? Just the Nat Geo Kids or Nat Geo Basic one?
They can just type in the book Photo Arc Wonders, or if they want a signed copy, we sell them too at joelsartori.com.
Okay, joelsartori.com. That's a good one. Everybody go there. Get a signed copy. What a wonderful gift for all the holidays coming up. And this one, if you're visiting somebody on Thanksgiving, bring this book. It is a wonderful book for everybody. Will be so busy, they won't rush you with that turkey. Okay?
There you go.
Okay. Thanks again, Joel. Bye-bye now.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay. I'm having a wonderful and fantastic day today. It is a Nat Geo day. I go from one great author to the other. And a photographer, of course, with the case of Joel Sartori. Wonderful, wonderful. And now I'm going to talk about, it's a season for Erica Engelhaupt, right? Did I pronounce that right, Erica?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, Erica Engelhaupt. And this one is, it's called Gory Details. And I guess we're right in season here. Adventures from the Dark Side of Science. And I see that you are also an editor, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. Well, where did you come out with the idea for this book?
Yes. So Gory Details, first of all, just to tell you a little bit about it, I guess, it's a collection of true stories about science, and in particular, all kinds of gross, morbid, taboo, and creepy science. So I'm a science journalist, and I started off Gory Details as a blog, first at Science News Magazine and then at National Geographic. And I started writing about pretty much anything that I found really weird and fascinating in the world of science. From forensic science to all kinds of, you know, creepy crawly animals and things like that.
So what's your background? Were you a forensic scientist?
I actually have a background in biology, and was an ecologist. I did a lot of field research and lab research, and I have always been interested in all kinds of mysteries in the world of science.
Okay, well, it's an interesting book. There were so many things that I didn't know. I don't know where exactly to start. What's your favorite stories out of it that you like to talk about?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's so many. Some of my favorite stories have to do with forensic science, I would say. That's really one of the, I guess, kind of goes to the heart of how I got interested in writing about creepy stuff,
Well, it's sort of, I got the feeling you're sort of like the Abby Shudo from NCIS. She would get so excited when she'd have maggots. I mean, she'd get, she'd want to show everybody, you want to see my, and I sort of got that same vibe when I was reading the book. I thought, yeah, well, if Abby Shudo would find this interesting, so you're right. I think from the forensic scientist point of view, you have many interesting stories in here.
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back to the fact that, when I was a kid, I was reading magazines like National Geographic and Discover and watching all the science shows on PBS. And I just really wanted to be an Encyclopedia Brown so badly, I wanted to solve mysteries. And so I think that I've always had that interest in using science to solve mysteries. And, so that's kind of translated into, the kind of thing like being interested in watching shows like CSI and finding all of the mistakes in the science.
Oh.
So one of the stories that really was fun for me to look into was something that I had heard about several years ago. There was this kind of bizarre phenomenon where disembodied feet were washing up onto beaches in the Pacific Northwest, and that's continued to happen. It's been going on for years. There've been at least 15 feet that have washed up onto beaches, and people find them and, started worrying about, was there a serial killer cutting off people's feet or what was going on here? So for me, it was a lot of fun looking into all of the different threads of science that explain why that would happen and finding out, it's probably not a serial killer at all. There's actually like natural explanations for why something like that would happen.
Okay, and did you discover that?
Yeah, and there's several things that are going on with that where you have to look at scientists who have done experiments looking at how bodies decompose underwater, and finding out that basically the feet are the thing that's likely to pop off, and then looking at the technology that's going into our footwear in the last decade or so, where our shoes, sneakers now have so much of these lightweight foams in them that they float.
So now,
the body in the water, so the feet pop off, and if they're wearing sneakers, then they float. And then you look at the, oceanography and winds and currents in this area where they keep washing up in the Salish Sea, and find out, through talking to oceanographers and so forth, that actually it's kind of the perfect storm of, properties that would bring feet ashore.
Which is why I don't swim in the ocean. But I'm always sort of freaked out about stuff like that. So you've made some field trips, I assume, to gather some of this information. What are some of your favorite field trips?
Well, yes, I've gotten to do a lot of really fun things in the course of researching this book, at least fun for me. I mean, getting to go to a lab where they're, studying maggots and basically farming them in huge quantities was interesting, but I'd say probably my favorite little field trip was to go visit a lab where they were studying what are called face mites. And these are little mites, arachnids, that actually live in all of our faces. So they're in your pores and my pores right now. But most of us never get to see them. I mean, they're microscopic, literally. You have to have a microscope to see them. But they are in all of our pores as we speak. And so I actually got the chance to go and have my face sampled and actually see some of the face mites living in my own face. And, you know, it was really cool. You know, it sounds kind of gross and creepy to think, you know, oh, there are these things that are, you know, living on your body. But, you know, we've come to understand that we have a whole microbiome, all of these bacteria and things that live in our guts that are actually a really important part of, you know, our bodies and how we function. And so we're also learning that there are things that live on our bodies, like these face mites. And they are, they're very mysterious. They're very hard to study, and we don't know that much about what they're doing in there. But if we all have them, and we don't have any ill effects, then, you know, they may be doing something good. They may be eating the gunk in our pores and helping keep it all cleaned out.
The title is good, gory. It sort of grosses you out to know that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, I think for me, I am not really interested in writing about gross science just for the purpose of grossing people out. You know, I'm always looking for stories where there's some fascinating bit of science in there, something that we can learn from it. So I really hope that people will walk away saying, you know, I thought it was going to be really gross, but it turned out it was actually really interesting.
Oh, it is all interesting. And there are many, you know, subjects and things that you write about that I never thought about and I never knew about.
Sure.
Now, as you were writing this, did you talk to people about some of these things? What did people think about what you were writing about?
You know, it's always a little bit of a challenge to describe to people what I'm working on. And when you say that you know, as a science writer, science journalist, when you say that you write about any kind of gross science, people tend to automatically think that you're writing for little kids. And, you know, there are lots of great kids' books on gross science and, you know, boogers and all of that kinds of stuff. But that's not really, you know, the kind of thing that I was interested in. I was interested more in kind of gross stuff for grown-ups and kind of exploring some of those questions that we become afraid to ask when we grow up. You know, I think we tend to think that it's okay for kids to be interested in gross and weird stuff, but we're supposed to grow out of that and lose interest in it when we get older, and, you know, lose that sense of, you know, curiosity that we have as kids. But I think that, you know, at least for me, I've certainly kept that sense of curiosity, and I think a lot of us have. We just become embarrassed to ask the questions.
Well, and you've answered questions here that people never thought anybody would have an answer for. So it is fascinating. Did you, I noticed that they wrote that you do comedy.
Well, I've done a couple of appearances doing, you know, telling stories. I like storytelling. And so I've told a couple of humorous stories. Whether people would think it was comedy is up to them, I suppose. But yeah, I enjoy that. And so even though I am always terrified of public speaking of any sort, you know, I have enjoyed getting up and doing storytelling. I think that's really kind of at the heart of what got me into science journalism, was telling these stories about, you know, parts of the world that other people have overlooked and finding those little interesting nuggets and solving those little mysteries of science.
Well, of course, one of the stories was about a biologist who stung himself with every conceivable insect.
Yeah, interesting guy. Really interesting guy. Yeah, there are a couple of scientists who I talked to who have done experiments like that. You know, sometimes there's no way to do an experiment without just doing it on yourself as a scientist. So that's what these guys have done. And that scientist in particular, Justin Schmidt, he has stung himself with all different kinds of insects and to describe basically what it feels like. And, you know, he's an entomologist. He's, you know, so he's interested in lots of other things about these insects. But his descriptions of what it felt like to be stung by some of them became, you know, so famous and so popular. They're really descriptive, you know. Almost, I describe them as being almost like tasting notes for a wine. You know, he'll describe like, you know, the particular, you know, effervescence of a certain insect sting and so forth. So, yeah, he's fantastic, and I love scientists like that who are, you know, basically just kind of willing to go the extra mile, who are willing to ask the questions that other people are afraid to ask, or, you know, take the leap in one way or another.
And what is the most murderous mammal? I think that's one of the stories you have.
It is. And a lot of people assume that it would be humans, but actually humans were down around number 30 on a list that a scientist put together of the most murderous mammals, meaning mammals who kill their own kind, who kill within their own species, unlike, you know, predator-prey type of relationship. So the most murderous of all of the mammals actually turned out to be meerkats, which are those cute little African animals that pop up almost like prairie dogs, like Timon from The Lion King. You know, they are actually hugely murderous. They kill their own kind very frequently. They have, you know, basically little territory wars and so forth, and in fact, it's the females of the species that tend to be the biggest killers.
Whoa. Wow. Yeah, I found that interesting. Did you go to Africa to see this?
No, I would love to, though. But I've personally only observed meerkats in the zoo.
So this is, you know, it's always fun to talk to National Geographic authors because Nat Geo is just so wonderful. They give the opportunity really to study so much of nature and to really get people intrigued with the stories about animals and to learn more. And, you know, since when you think about it, you know, they've been doing this since 1888.
Isn't it amazing?
It is amazing. And I know that as a child, I just was always looking forward to getting our yellow magazine. You know, that was our way that we learned about the outside world, you know, living in sort of farm country. We didn't have any outlets. Yeah. We didn't have libraries. We didn't have a lot of books. But Nat Geo is what really turned me into a world traveler because of Nat Geo. I've been all over the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I think National Geographic, you know, when you think about the kind of stuff that I'm writing about, you know, it's kind of the dark side of nature, but that's really another fascinating side of nature. You know, I think we've always read stories in National Geographic about, you know, predators and, it, you know, nature is pretty bloody, really, when it comes down to it. And so I think that I'm really looking at and trying to foster an appreciation for some of those weird and fascinating animals that maybe we've overlooked. You know, the face mites and the parasites of the world, you know, haven't maybe gotten as much attention as the lions and tigers and bears, but they're equally fascinating when you start looking at all of the amazing creatures and how all of the ways that they have adapted to survive.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about National Geographic, that they give this opportunity for writers and photographers to go out there and do this kind of research and bring it to us so that we are just more knowledgeable and more interested in the world around us.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, my thing that I always tell people is just stay curious. Like I said, you know, I think that sometimes we expect people to lose their curiosity, their childlike curiosity about the world as they get older. And I say, you know, if that's the case, hey, don't grow up. You know, stay curious.
Now, is there a website that people can particularly go to see some of your work, to see more about the stuff that you've done?
Absolutely. You can go to gorydetailsbook.com, which is easier than spelling my name, my website. So you can go to gorydetailsbook.com, and that'll take you to my website. You can find out more about the book and other things that I've written, and find links for, of course, purchasing the book and other things.
Okay, that's a great idea, I think, because you have some interesting information there and just more details, because it's a fascinating book. And I think that, as you said, it's something that we need to sort of know about. We need to know more about the world around us, and this is one side of it. And it's gory, but as I said, it's not really, it's stuff that we know, but we don't know. We don't know the details, and that's why the word details was so perfect to have in the title, because we know about the stuff, but we don't know the details. And you certainly give it to us exactly in very detailed format.
Well, I hope so, and I hope people find it weird and fascinating and really piques their curiosity.
Well, I think they will. Again, thank you so much for being on the program today. It's always, as I said, a thrill to have anyone from Nat Geo on, and it's Erica, spelt with a K, Erica Engelhaupt, and the book is Gory Details, Adventures from the Dark Side of Science. And everyone, get this book and find out some stuff that you don't know. It will certainly intrigue you. Again, thank you so much, Erica, for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, and three Nat Geo books in a row. And I want to thank, of course, our sponsors. Let's play Big Ed. Can we pull up EHS? We'll play that commercial now, and then I'll come back. I want to talk a little bit about Bill Larson.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Great. Okay. Well, that's wonderful. I want to say that I talked to my cousin in California yesterday, and he used to dread the first of the month because his bill for electricity and water were both so very high. The water bill is still horrendous, but he told me that his electric bill, it's a joke. I mean, it's practically nothing. And sometimes it is nothing because it feeds back into the thingamajiggy. And he's so happy, I can tell you. And I'm talking, in California, his bill, monthly bill, was around $600. He's got a big house. And it's $600 a month for electricity. And now it's virtually nothing. Solar energy, wow, that has really saved him. And so he's very happy with it. So go EHS, and if you want, you get yourself some beautiful solar panels up there, it's a great company. So please go EHS and get solar panels. And I also want to talk about Bill Larson. Bill Larson of Larson & Larson is going to be on next month, and we're going to be talking about some more intellectual property problems that people have been having recently. And so that's exciting. But most importantly, I want to tell you about Thursday. Thursday, I have Lee Child and his brother Andrew Child on because their new book was released today. But I didn't want to talk to him, to either one of them today, because I know that they are so busy. They got up at 2 in the morning to talk to British television, British morning television. So I know that they've been they've been up all night, and they're going to be up all day talking all over the country on radio stations. But they will not give anybody the full hour that they're going to give me on Thursday. So I'm very excited that Lee Child and Andrew Child, or as most of you know, my listeners know him as Drew, because Drew, of course, I met him and his wife, Tasha Alexander, when they were here at the Vinoy Hotel for BoucherCon, 3 years ago? My goodness, the years have just been crazy. And both Drew and Tasha were hosts on Joy on Paper. They took over the program one day when I was in this pandemic-y mode and I couldn't get out of the house. And they were so kind as to take over and host Joy on Paper. So it's pretty thrilling, you know, when you have Andrew Grant and Tasha Alexander being co-hosts, well, being hosts on Joy on Paper. So I'm very grateful to them for that. And I'm looking forward to talking to Drew and, of course, to Lee Child, whose name is actually Jim. And so that's going to be on Thursday. And that's very exciting. And then next week, I'm going to be talking on Tuesday to Leslie Carroll, and it is Marie Antoinette's birthday. So we're going to do a special Marie Antoinette birthday program. That's going to be fun. Anyway, you know, everybody, NaNoWriMo is coming up. I hope you're ready. Start on November 1st writing your book, because I had Rhonda Green on here the other week, and she talked about how she started writing with NaNoWriMo, and you can do it. And now she was on my program for her book last week. And I hope that you are going to get busy and be ready on November 1st. Because remember what I tell you. I always tell you the same thing. Listen to me. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And it will happen. It could happen. You know, that's what I want for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries, because they are so good, and it would be so much fun to see them on streaming, because I need something new. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. I would have been a tremendous general. I'm telling you, boy, they would have had to give me 5 stars. I would have been so good. And I want to go to the War College and talk to these people, because they need my advice, I tell you, right now. Okay, bye-bye now.